Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What should America's grand strategy be in these first years after the Bush administration? Can we resist the forces of globalization? Should we? And what will it take to ensure that our efforts on the world stage not only serve our interests as an individual nation, but as citizens of a large and complex world? My guest today has some clear ideas for recovering what has been lost in the 12 years since we launched the war on terror, beginning with a 12-step program based on the same recovery methods used by addicts. Thomas P.M. Barnett is a frequent advisor to the Secretary of Defense, the U.S. State Department, and Special Operations Command, among others. He also writes for Esquire and the Scripps Howard News Service. His new book is called Great Powers: America and the World After Bush. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Your first step in this program is admitting that we are powerless over the forces of globalization. What tells you, first of all, that we are out of sync with the progress of globalization right now?
Well, a lot of this has to do with self-awareness, is my argument. We need to understand that it's not the EU, the European Union, but these United States that constitute the world's oldest and most successful multinational economic, political, security union in human history. We are a globalization in miniature. Our American system of states uniting, economies integrating, networks proliferating, and rules accumulating is basically the model that we sought to project upon the planet, beginning with Teddy Roosevelt's earliest dreams, the naivete of Wilson after World War I, the sophistication of Franklin Roosevelt after World War II to create an international liberal trade order that begets the West, which becomes enormously successful, and ultimately co-opts the East, and we start talking about a global economy across the late 1980s, and then across the early and mid-1990s, we start describing that as globalization. So the first point I want to get across is this is a world very much of our creating. And we have been so successful in making the world safe enough and connected enough for a lot of these rising great powers to emerge, that we can't all of a sudden turn on this thing and say, hey, this is Frankenstein's monster. I had nothing to do with this. I got to figure out how to protect myself against it. We need to understand that this is a competitive environment because that's the way we prefer it. We model it very much on ourselves. And while we have power in the face of globalization, and there are things we can do to protect ourselves during a crisis like this, we're no longer in charge of globalization. We have been way too successful in making this happen.
So is the fact that we're not in charge the reason that so many Americans are convinced that we are in decline specifically due to globalization?
Right. I would argue. We've been successful in making, for the first time in history, a strong, prosperous, peaceful Britain, France, Germany, and Russia. Never happened before in Europe. All exist at the same time. No prospects of great power war, but on that basis, they have more of a say in the world. Same for Asia. We made this this model of integration with Asia work over the last 20, 30 years, the so-called informal Bretton Woods II kind of model where we financed their export-driven growth so long as they were willing to take their trade surpluses and plow it back into U.S. debt markets and accept that we were going to be the regional military leviathan for the system. What we've created, besides an over-leveraged position with that, is we've created for the first time in history a rising, strong, increasingly prosperous, very peaceful India, Korea, China, and Japan. You know, and those are amazing accomplishments, but with those amazing accomplishments comes this sense of there are a lot of great powers out there, hence the title of my book, and we don't have the same control. But we got to understand we really have the same leadership, and you don't want to confuse the two. Being a leader doesn't necessarily mean you get to control people's actions. In many ways, it's our example as the progenitor of this globalization and the rules that we select, the new rules we create during this crisis, which represents our biggest power asset.
What would you say, Tom, is the lasting legacy of the Bush-Cheney administration?
Well, the reason why I use I have a first chapter called The Seven Deadly Sins of Bush-Cheney, and then I there's sins and there must be penance, and so you take the model of a self-help recovery program for an addict or an alcoholic. So you're trying to get us off this bender we've been on. if you think of globalization as a big bell curve, okay, big, fat middle, thin shoulders, they got very obsessed on the shoulders of globalization, meaning kind of on the left, if you think baseline security issues, weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, okay? The world has dealt with these issues for quite some time. We get really jacked about them after 9/11, and we make our entire foreign policy about terrorism and making sure people don't get weapons of mass destruction, sacrificing a lot of cooperation in that process. We also become obsessed, thanks to the intervention in Iraq, on the other shoulder, the other extreme of that bell curve, and that is the top-line political achievement called democracy. We become sort of committed to accelerated democracy. And if you think about those, you know, baseline security achievement on one side, top-line political achievement on the other, in the middle is this vast revolutionary spread of the global economy and the rise, for the first time in human history, of a truly global middle class. So they got obsessed about the extremes of this process, lost track of the middle. We need to get more in touch with that. The financial crisis forces us to do it in some part because it puts at risk our sense of a centering middle class ideology that has sustained our country for, you know, about 150 years. Now is bumping up against a rising version of that middle class ideology on the planet, and making those two coexist and become comfortable with each other, I would argue that's the number one task in terms of our grand strategy in the 21st century.
Yeah, and your point is that most of the world is existing somewhere in the middle of that continuum, not necessarily an immediate security threat, but not necessarily ready to take the next step to be a full democracy.
Right. I mean, they look at it and they say, like a China, you know, to make America the equivalent of China, you have to invite everybody in Latin America to come live inside the contiguous United States. And that wouldn't even get us the number of poor inside of China. Okay, so you got to understand, when we come to them and say, make it all about terrorism, they say, well, I'm concerned about it, and I'm dealing with it. It's not going to be the focus of my entire life right now. And when we say, hey, get it to democracy as quickly as possible, they're saying, I've got this 700 million poor inside my country. I need to deal with making them happy, because if they're not happy, I don't have a country anymore. I don't have a regime anymore. And your problem set gets a lot bigger under those circumstances than, am I democratic enough for you? Am I hunting down and killing enough terrorists fast enough for you?
Thomas P.M. Barnett is my guest. His new book is called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. Do we need to accept the fact that we will always see the world somewhat differently than the way the rest of the world sees itself?
That's a good question. You know, we have a blind spot here because we've been so successful. I like to say we export rules more than anything else, and we don't understand that. There's a great map I describe in the book that I found on the Internet that relabels the states of America yeah. according to countries with equivalent GDPs. So California becomes France, Mexico is, or Canada is the equivalent of Texas, Wisconsin is the equivalent of South Africa, the biggest economy in the African continent, and Tennessee is the equivalent of Saudi Arabia, one of the most powerful economies in the world. We don't recognize ourselves as a multinational union. We forget all the rules it took to make this amazing level of transaction rates occur across our states, the movement of goods and services and money and all that stuff. We forget how efficient we've become in it, because if you added up all those states that were the equivalent GDPs of our states from around the world, that's 2 billion people, and yet we make a $13 trillion economy happen on just 300 million people. So we got to understand our success in spreading our rules makes the world look more like us over time. And so when we look at that world, we don't see what the big fuss is about globalization coming to these places, because it looks like you're becoming more American. What we don't understand is becoming more American in the sense that we're the furthest along in this experiment in multinationalism. That's huge social and economic revolution for a lot of these traditional societies. And it creates blowback in the form of terrorism and radical groups.
Yeah, you say that we now have a shallower but wider pool of enemies than ever before. Can you explain that?
Well, you know, I got into this business 20 years ago. One of the first things I did was a revamping of our strategic nuclear strategy. So, you know, the timetable there was, how do you blow up half the planet in 7 minutes? Okay. Now, I will tell you, the number one problem we deal with time and time again is, I got a UAV, an unmanned aerial vehicle, on the other side of the world. It spots the right guy with a long beard, and I want to identify that guy and kill him, if necessary and if desired, in about 7 minutes, okay? So I've gone from a world, in my 20-year career where we talked about, you know, how do you respond to global nuclear war in 7 minutes? How do you wipe out half the planet? To how do you kill one bad actor in 7 minutes? And that is a huge downgrading of violence in the system. We really don't worry about global nuclear Armageddon anymore. Great power war, 64 years and counting. There's never been a war between great powers. State-on-state war is disappearing. Most of the violence is inside countries now, okay? And the biggest actors we can find in terms of fear factor are transnational terrorist groups. To me, that's the weeds compared to the redwoods we were dealing with at the beginning of my career. So much shallower pool, but in a super-empowered world, you know, if we have an economic empire, it's one that enriches and empowers individuals, and one of the byproducts of that is bad actors connected by networks can do more dangerous things to us. So there's more of them, but what they can manage is, by and large, much smaller than what we've had to deal with in the past.
You recommend that we make direct overtures to violent non-state actors whenever that's reasonably possible. What kind of overtures are appropriate?
Well, one thing we got to understand in this process is, you know, people are going to reach for more religion, not less. When globalization comes to a traditional society, and you go from economies of sustenance, where you have a very strict moral code because, you know, you don't put up with homosexuality, everybody gets married, they crank babies, we all plant potatoes around here, that's how we get through the winter. You know, that's kind of a sustenance mindset, and you've got a religion that matches that in terms of a strict moral code. Globalization comes in and says, hey, marry outside your tribe, get an education, see the world. Women, don't automatically respond to arranged marriages, get an education, put off pregnancies. I mean, these are all huge social changes. In that process of change, you got to expect people to reach for religion time and time again, and you need to not be frightened by that because it really gives us the opportunity to clean up a lot of globalization, much in the same way that religious groups in America. Go back and look at our late 19th century evolution when our capitalism was the nastiest and most unequal and most environmentally damaging. What we did then was we had a lot of religious groups arise, and they really pushed the progressive agenda that cleaned up our system. I think you're going to see the same thing happen on a global basis. So when people from that pool arise and some of them reach for violence in the anger and impatience about social change, don't automatically turn them into your enemy forever. Look at their anger, meet their demand for cultural identity, give them their religion, accommodate it, and then ask them what they can do in terms of their desire to change to improve the system, as opposed to, I'm going to demonize you and put you outside of my realm and hunt you down automatically. So it's a lot of accommodating of people's desire to maintain their identity in the face of this ultimate reformatting, remixing process called globalization, and not automatically demonizing them for simply wanting to retain identity.
So it's not a matter of, say, negotiating with terrorists. This is about going to the broader group that might contain those terrorists.
You're always looking at the pool.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, Islam is not your problem. Islam is a great religion for getting through hard times. It has a strict moral code. Catholicism's been like that through a lot of history. So among a lot of these less developed places, the version of Islam, the version of Catholicism, of Christianity, whatever, tends to be stricter than the one we have in our neck of the woods. You don't want to look at that as a problem. You want to look at that as a good thing and then understand it's a small fragment within that Islamic world that is truly fundamentalist, that really wants to disconnect from an evil world. Okay, those guys, if they get violent enough, you're going to have to hunt them down and kill them, but that's a very tiny percentage.
Thomas P.M. Barnett is my guest. His new book is called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, talk a little bit about the Obama administration and what it will have to do in these years after Bush. You're welcome to join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Thomas P.M. Barnett is my guest. He writes for Esquire magazine and the Scripps Howard News Service. He's also a frequent ongoing advisor to the Secretary of Defense, the State Department, and Special Operations Command, among others. His new book is called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Tom, to what extent will the Obama administration, whether it intends to or not, ultimately be defined by its reversal of what took place under George W. Bush?
Well, I think it's clear that they're going to spend most of any putative first term, and I think there's a good chance he gets a second term because we're probably going to be in an upswing, and that usually works for re-election. He's going to spend the first term basically unwinding the strategic tie-down in Iraq and to a certain extent in Afghanistan, while simultaneously ramping up that effort in Afghanistan to include Pakistan a bit, but nowhere near the sort of body requirements we had in terms of troop rotations. So the overall effect will be to kind of disengage our forces from the very, very heavy rotation that the Bush administration had, so much so that I like to cite the kind of biblical story of, Joseph talking to the Egyptian pharaoh, interpreting the dream of the seven fat years in terms of crop returns, and then adjusting to the reality of seven lean years and kind of storing up for that scenario. I think we've so used up the force, the individuals, especially in the Army and Marines, that we are looking at seven fairly lean years across the first and putative second term for an Obama in terms of what we're going to be able to do to address whatever security situations emerge. That in and of itself forces a certain amount of strategic security realignment, forces us to kind of seek out the help of other countries, especially in an Afghanistan-Pakistan region where you're dealing with regional players like Russia, India, China, the Iranians, the Turks. So, you know, an adjustment and a more burden-sharing mindset, I think, is inevitable. The other big hole that you're going to dig out from, obviously, is the economic environment that we're currently enduring. And between the two of them, I see almost no possibility for any serious kind of grand strategic direction to emerge from a first Obama administration. They're going to be so consumed by sort of unwinding these situations, economic and strategic, that most of their wiggle room has basically been eliminated.
Is there a danger that that direction of unwinding can go too far?
There always is. You know, we talk about the Vietnam syndrome coming out of the Vietnam experience. The irony there, of course, is that those who really understood what we were doing in Vietnam realized that we were getting pretty darn good at doing the nation building and the counterinsurgency near the end, but that evolution took too long, and we lost the support of the American public by that time. So we went into a real, I don't do this anymore sort of mindset that lasted, arguably, right through the Iraq invasion. One of our problems, we invaded in Iraq with the understanding that we were going to have full responsibility for the aftermath, and yet we didn't have a military that did that. It wasn't prepared for it, didn't have doctrine for it, didn't have the equipment for it, didn't train for it. So we've had this adjustment in terms of the situation with Iraq that arguably makes us a lot more prepared in terms of our military forces for the kind of world we're living in, of failed states and conflict that exists mostly inside states or spills over borders or is constituted in the form of transnational terrorist actors. So it would be ironic, I would argue, and it's one of the things I try to argue in this book, for us to take the lesson from Iraq to be, we're never going to do Iraq well, or we're never going to do Iraq again, because we've actually learned now through the crucible of the experience we've had in the last 5 years, we've actually learned how to do Iraq well. But again, you have to factor in the burnout of the force. So some withdrawal is inevitable, and yet I would argue we're better positioned to deal with the world in terms of our military assets than we were for the last 15, 20 years. So I wouldn't say indulge in that too much.
You also write about the great unsung success of the Bush administration, which is the effort to develop China as a legitimate stakeholder in global security. First of all, what has that yielded? And then how did the U.S. specifically help make that happen?
Well, the first thing you have to say is, in the grand scheme of things, the Iraq War 100 years from now is going to be interpreted somewhat on the scale of Britain's Boer War in South Africa, modern South Africa. I mean, it was certainly a turning point to certain internal evolutions within the government and the system of the state itself, of Britain, but it didn't have system-wide effect. They're going to look back at this point in history and say, the system changer is obviously China's rise. And how you deal with a rising power within an existing global security order, that's a huge question, because when such powers have arisen in the past, often it creates arms races, it creates kind of great power rivalries, often it results in war. So you have a Bush administration that needs to be credited for the 8 years in which it did not screw up our relationship with the Chinese. There is a level of financial interdependence between us and China that is profound. We have brought them into that kind of Bretton Woods scheme, that informal one that happened over the last 30 years between us and Asia, where we brought them into the same package we had for Japan. We'll finance, in effect, your export-driven growth as long as you buy our debt instruments, and we'll be the regional security leviathan. On that basis, you know, we've brought China up very successfully, you could argue, as a dominant global power, not picking any stupid fights, encouraging their peaceful rise, but we've so made ourselves indebted to them that the financial level of interdependence right now is quite profound and really represents one of the great flashpoint dangers in the system as we go through this economic crisis. What if we do something wrong that freaks out the Chinese, that makes them want to dump some large chunk of that $2 trillion in currency reserves that they currently hold in dollars? If that were to happen, then you could be talking kind of an economic meltdown scenario, not that different from Smoot-Hawley, the tariff in the early 30s, and what kind of depressive impact that had on global trade. So you got to understand what we try to do to make China strong, how that's made us very, very interconnected and interdependent, and then realize in that interdependency, we need to be careful how we proceed forward. So I wanted to start the book by pointing out that Bush did that well, and use that as sort of a reminder, you know, not to make anything dangerous happen in the next few months and years, because China really isn't ready for the level of global leadership that we're in effect asking from it right now. It's just not ready.
How effectively is China using soft power today?
Well, there's been a lot of exploration of that. I argue that they've sort of played good cop to our bad cop. You know, America has run around the world the last 7 years sort of kicking rear ends and taking names and looking for terrorists and demanding accelerated democracy. And the Chinese, you know, they come to Africa and they say, hey, buddy, I'm not here to bring democracy. I'm not here to kick you out of your government job. Here's a thick red envelope full of cash. If you can make that road between your mine and your port happen so I can start exporting or sucking a lot of resources out of your country. You know, that sort of soft power is an easy sell to poorer countries, less sophisticated countries. They swoop in, they promise all manner of economic development. They got no desire to force any sort of political development. In fact, they're against it, I could argue. They have no concern about your human rights record, no concern about how you may be raping your environment. So they make it pretty easy for countries to capitalize on their huge resource requirements, and it makes them, you know, the friend of a lot of negative regimes around the world because they're so darn accommodating. I don't see that as a huge source of power for them over the long haul. They're paying above market prices for a lot of these resources. They're dealing with a lot of difficult regimes who will turn on them at a moment's notice. And what they found in many instances with these countries is you can pay off the central government until the rebels in the distant regions of the country start realizing what a glass jaw you have, and they start killing your oil rig workers, say, in eastern Ethiopia. And pretty soon you're paying off the local rebels and the center. So your sense of real influence of these countries is limited to how much cash you have on hand to bribe them. So it's not the model, I think, that's as impressive as people make it out to be. It doesn't really represent a great threat to our authority if we're more sophisticated and understanding of these countries' situations as we interact with them.
So rather than responding directly, it sounds like you think it's enough to allow China enough rope to sort of hang itself on its inappropriate exercise of soft power.
Well, they're going to create blowback. You know, I tell the Chinese whenever I go there, you know, America's the one country in the world that is kind of on the leading edge of understanding that globalization in its modern form now is being driven more by China than anybody else. Historically, people look at globalization and say, aha, This is Westernization. This is Americanization. And the Americans are behind all of this. But when you turn on those 3 billion capitalists in the East and a good billion are found plus in China, the world starts to realize that what is driving globalization's integrating networks now is not so much the Americans. We're not the ones pioneering this stuff in these less developed countries. It's the Asians more and more. So the natural blowback and the natural targeting of Chinese interests by opponents of globalization is going to pull China into the mix of having to defend it more and more. And I see in that a learning curve for them. I mean, they're going to have to get off the mercantilist strategies that they pursued up to now, the neocolonialism they brought to Africa. But I see that as an opportunity for us, because in many of these situations, we have more political military concerns. They have more economic network concerns. There's a lot of complementarity between those two. They want to make Africa get connected. We want Africa to be connected. But we want it under certain circumstances of security and safety, and in terms of certain circumstances of the evolution of the political systems there. So a lot of overlap, I would argue, in terms of strategic interests and a real opportunity, not necessarily just to watch them fail, but to help them progress in their learning in this regard.
Thomas P.M. Barnett is my guest. His new book is called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hello. I had a couple of observations about what your guest had to say about Iraq and how we've learned things there, and it would kind of be ironic or too bad if we weren't able to apply those in some way, those lessons. But I'm not so sure about that at all. I know millions of people left Iraq. Neighborhoods that were diverse became very ethnocentric, and I know that very much changed over time, our whole situation we were dealing with, and that wasn't really anything we did. And then we started paying people to be on our side, and that's still an experiment. We don't even know what will happen when we quit paying those people, and we don't even know how long it'll work anyway. I just don't know that we've really learned anything yet in Iraq, and I wondered what he had to say. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call.
Right. My argument was more about the evolution within our forces, how we've changed in the direction of having more assets to deal with these kinds of situations. With regard to Iraq itself, the caller makes a lot of really accurate descriptions there. What you got to understand is Iraq was basically a fake state. Okay, it was created by the Brits very cynically when they were leaving the Middle East. They slapped together three peoples, Arab Shia, Arab Sunni, and non-Arab Sunni Kurds. Okay, so you got an overlapping kind of civilizational point here. Three different communities, coming to a point that they draw a line around and call Iraq. When we get there and we give locals the opportunity to pursue freedom, even in the midst of violence, and it often unleashes violence because there tends to be longstanding grievances between these groups, the first thing they did was to separate themselves. And a certain amount of ethnic cleansing resulted, just like what we saw in Yugoslavia, which was a classic fake state imposed by outsiders when given the opportunity, reconstituted itself in its constituent forms. Our purpose in Iraq and our learning curve, I would argue, not that different from what we learned in Yugoslavia. You have to manage that downward curve, that slide towards ethnic cleansing, which is, some of it is inevitable. You have to allow individual constituent parts of this fake state to achieve some sense of identity and then respect that sense of identity by allowing self-control, by allowing control over their own security as a first measure. And then you have to start knitting this place together in terms of overlapping economic interests. So there's like there's a curve there. A fake state, could have been held together by a dictator. You take that lid off, it devolves down into its constituent parts. Violence is involved in that downward path. Then you got to bottom that thing out, and you got to bring it back up to understanding the overlapping security interests and economic interests. Then you have the possibilities for federation, which I would argue we've basically achieved in Iraq with Sunnis running Sunnis, Shia running Shia, Kurds been running themselves for about 15 years, and Baghdad basically falling, not surprisingly, to the dominant ethnic group there. 60% of the country is Shia. So that process of kind of decomposing fake states and then recomposing them, I think we're going to do this multiple times in Central Asia, in the Middle East. We're going to do it a lot across Africa because we're dealing with a legacy of a lot of fake borders, drawn by outsiders and a lot of fake states that were left behind by the colonialization process.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Declan in Flower Mound. Hey, Declan. Hi, Declan. Okay. We will come back to the phones in just a minute. We have an email here from Sid in Dallas who writes, just last week, two nuclear submarines belonging to France and England collided with each other, between them carrying 100 nuclear warheads. In the global age, what is the logic behind this kind of behavior from the Western world monitoring our security?
Well, I mean, that's just a screw-up between two militaries. And the kind of danger presented by the communities within those two militaries, the submarine communities, whose entire raison d'etre in the nuclear age has been remain so stealthy that nobody can find you because you have the ultimate deterrent. You have nuclear devices that can be launched in a second strike capability that no one can touch. That's how untouchable you are. So we got a rule set within these individual submarine communities. Go out there, don't tell anybody what you're doing. And this was a one in a bajillion sort of case, two submarines bumping into each other. I mean, the danger there was really negligible. I mean, this stuff is not nitroglycerin. You don't shake a nuclear device and have it go off. But what it reflects is that we're still in a certain big war mindset. We maintain those capabilities. And by that example, we're actually encouraging rising great powers like a Brazil, a China, to copy us by reaching for similar devices as they plus up their militaries and assume a more great power stance. So you have the Brazilians saying, I want some nuclear submarines, I want some attack submarines, I want some ballistic missile submarines, and you say, why do you want that exactly? How does that represent a sensible response to your economic interests? Because I can tell you, there's been one torpedo fired in the last 50 years in anger. So it's a reflection of a past that we need to move off from. And yet, having nuclear weapons actually keeps great power war off the table, so they're good.
Thomas P.M. Barnett is my guest. His new book is called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Thomas P.M. Barnett is my guest this hour. His latest book is called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. I want to talk for a minute, Tom, about how you understand globalization, and in particular, outsourcing of lower-end jobs, something that we continue to lament, especially as the economy shrinks. You look at this as similar to the way that a general contractor hires out certain jobs to sort of stay at the top of the pyramid.
And that says to us, we got to do a whole lot more in terms of educating our workforce, both at an entry level and then in terms of its lifetime commitment to updating its skills as it moves through careers that arguably are going to feature maybe participation in two or three or even four industries across the lifetime of a career. So the notion that you can come to a company that your dad worked at and your grandpa worked at and have the confidence that you're going to stay with that company or that industry for the course of your lifetime. It's just not there anymore. Things have progressed in terms of globally integrated production to the point where, you know, globalization integrates trade by disaggregating production and distributing those aspects or means of production across the global landscape according to where it makes the most sense in terms of the cheapest resources, labor being a key one. Trying to fight that by keeping those jobs at home is very, very hard. Manufacturing is a good example. It continues to be about 25% of our export earnings, and yet we use fewer and fewer people to pursue that manufacturing. And, of course, your counter to that can't be, I want the most labor-intensive manufacturing on the planet in order to keep jobs here because you're going to price yourself out of a competitive stance by doing that. Having said that, if you think of the 20th century as a century of physics, and a lot of the industries that come out of that kind of understanding. The 21st century, by all accounts, is going to be a century of biology. And there are tremendous amounts of profits to be made in that realm, I would argue, because when life-extending technologies come more and more online, cures for cancer, that kind of stuff, the amount of disposable income that the a global middle class will be willing to put against those capabilities as they come online, almost unlimited. So we can make ourselves a very profitable leader in the global economy, but you're going to have a different kind of requirement for workforce if we're not, you know, the center of global car manufacturing like we were in the 20th century and are instead the center of global biogenetic nano manufacturing. That's a more complex package. I don't think we have the educational system to manage that at this point, nor do we have the political commitment to change that system, and we desperately need it.
And ultimately, you see the jobs that we outsource in whatever industry it ends up being as a far stronger recruiting tool than anything that, say, a terrorist organization might wield.
Well, I mean, look at it this way. The Middle East has a youth bulge right now between 15 and 30. I guarantee you that youth bulge is going to middle age over the next 15 years, and that 15 to 30 chunk is going to be sitting squarely at 30 to 45. We estimate on the low end 50 million jobs need to be created in the Middle East and North Africa to absorb that youth bulge. At the high end, maybe as many as 100 million. So that tells me I got to make those 75, let's say, million young men and women happy in this global economy, because if I don't make them happy and if I deny them that opportunity and they can't get married, as a young male, say, in Egypt describes to me, because there's no job, I can't get a job, I can't get the money to make a dowry happen, I can't get married. You cut people off from their dreams like that, you're going to create, you know, a certain amount of blowback and anger. Some of that will get translated into transnational terrorism. So I look at that package and I say, part of our calculations in terms of how we interact with the outside world, is we got to accommodate the reality that those 75 million jobs need to be created in the Middle East. And we can take care of that 75 million in terms of bombs and bullets, or we can take care of them in terms of foreign direct investment we make to tap into that labor, to integrate them into producer and buyer chains in the global economy. But either way, we're going to have to deal with it. And we can't just say our only commitment is to American jobs, because we'll create a beggar thy neighbor mindset within the global economy that would be much like what we did in the 1930s.
Let's go back to the phones and speak next to Andrew in Frisco. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. How's it going today, Chris?
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your guest, with the idea of globalization in mind, I wanted to see if he could perhaps comment on President Obama's economic stimulus plan, whether he thinks it's going to be beneficial or if this is more a global problem as far as the recession is concerned, and if we're going to be able to extricate ourselves from the problem as a singular nation instead of examining the entire global economy.
I think you got to look at them as very much an overlapping problem set. I mean, what we've been is the global demand center for a long time in the global economy. And because of that, we've had the world kind of reorient itself around our ambitions and our desires and our tastes, okay? We've done that to the extent where we're as over-leveraged as a society as we can possibly be. And yet, to restart the global economy in the current conditions, it gets really hard to expect somebody else to automatically kind of pop up and become an alternative global demand center. I mean, it would be great if China could manage that through their massive $600 billion stimulus package. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. I don't think you can make that happen in a Europe or a Japan. So you're kind of stuck realizing if you want to restart the global economy, on some level you got to restart American consumption, okay? And that sounds like, you know, the hair of the dog that bit you in terms of what are you doing? You're increasing your imports. You're increasing your demand in the system. Doesn't that put you in an even more over-leveraged position? Yeah, we're looking at trillion-dollar deficits for a couple of years at least. But there's no alternative given the structure of the global economy right now other than doing that. As we do it, we need to think about restructuring the way we interact economically with the outside world. We need to recognize that this emerging global middle class, which by some estimates, if you include kind of lower-end middle-class consumers in countries like India and China, I mean, that's about 50% of the global population. They want a lot of stuff. That's where the disposable income is going to be happening in the next 20, 30 years, to the extent where economists will argue next 20, 30 years, 80% of growth in the global economy is going to be found in these places. So we need to be smarter about accessing those populations. We need to focus on what kind of exports we can deliver to them to improve our balance of trade with the outside world, because we can't consume the way we have for the last 20, 30 years. And we need to understand selling to these kinds of people is sort of like selling to lower American middle class frontier people of the 1880s and 1890s. They're going to expect some very robust technology, very high value, long-lasting, very good value for their bucks. They're very brand conscious. So this kind of restructuring our mindset and tapping into this emerging global middle class is a huge challenge, but it's the long-term avenue out of this unsustainable consumption pattern that we currently have.
You write about the importance of creating this global team of rivals. Can you talk about what those rivals can do for us that we can't achieve unilaterally?
Well, what we did with Iraq is sort of a good example. You know, the Bush administration very much focused on maintaining the primacy, as they put it, of American power. So we sort of said to the world, you know, Iraq is a bad player. We all agree on that. But we're going to fight this war on our timetable. And if you're not ready to sign up for the war, we said, in effect, don't show up for the peace and forget about the contracts. And we made this not just an American war, which we could handle with great ease. It was a brilliantly executed war. We lost very few people over about 6 weeks, toppled the regime with ease. But then we found ourselves on the far side of that, dealing with the post-war and not many friends. If you look at who wins the infrastructure contracts in Iraq over the last 3 or 4 years, it turns out it's the Iranians, it's the Turks, it's the Chinese, the Indians, the Russians. Okay, none of these countries showed up for the war. All of them are natural regional integrators in that part of the world. And you start to realize, boy, they were going to be our partners all along anyway. So we've had this mindset in the U.S. national security community that says, come as you are to our allies. We say, come as you are to any war. Bring what you can. We'll supply the rest. We have to move beyond just that very accommodating mindset on the war to include the notion of come when you can. You know, not just come to the war if you're able, and that's our traditional Western allies, NATO, for example, but come if you can't come for the war, come for the peace, and let us not be biased about your participation in the post-war as opposed to the war itself, and understand we can't possibly bring to the table all the assets required to reconnect a society and an economy as large as Iraq to the outside world. That's the kind of team of rivals that I'm talking about. Understanding that friends of ours, even competitors of ours, in a global economic sense, can be useful to us at various points in a process if we start to recognize that we can't do it all ourselves.
Thomas P.M. Barnett is my guest. We have on the line next another Thomas calling from Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. I've listened to you, you know, for a while, your book, The New Map, and everything. But I think you're kind of glossing over our role in much of that area. We support a lot of dictatorships and things like that. I agree with your, you know, the financial liberation, but I think it has to come with political liberation. And we have over 750 military bases overseas. If we didn't have all those, we could probably afford to educate our people here and have health care. You're presupposing a military and of course, presupposing, I guess, that we're going to force a will with these dictatorships and make sure everybody toes our line. And I know that can't be easily undone. But your turn.
We've had a tendency to choose security over justice. And we've had a tendency to think of ourselves as a status quo power because of what we represented as the alternative to the Soviet empire of force across the Cold War. We haven't gotten out of the habit of preferring security over justice in a lot of these situations. And we have neglected the reality that even if we're a force of status quo in a political military sense, this globalization that we've unleashed upon the world is a huge social economic revolution, which proposes and demands a lot of change from below. To the extent that we're responsible for global security, it would be great if we didn't need to have the tremendous stretch of bases around the world. I would point out that what people call the 750 bases, you know, the reality is we have serious bases in about 30 countries around the world. What we have in the rest of the world are tiny, small units inside existing local base structures created by the local military. And what that reflects is that we're trying to network around the planet to a huge extent. So these are, vast majority of them, pretty small presences, reflecting a more networked approach to a more networked environment. I consider that highly appropriate. You get rid of all that, it's not going to cure our defense, our budget priorities in terms of the United States, where we're still spending less as a percentage of GDP than at any point in the Cold War history, going all the way back to the Second World War. Our big problem in terms of our resource constraints with the federal budget tends to be in the Social Security and the medical. So you can say getting rid of that role will make everything better, and not supporting security over justice, definitely an improvement there. But the reality is a lot of these countries that we're dealing with, you know, globalization creates so much social economic change. Expecting them to turn themselves into democracies overnight is really fantastic. Most countries, when they embrace the outside world, they tend to do so as single-party states. That tends to last for about 30, 40, 50 years until they get a middle class, they get some middle age in terms of their demographic structure, and that's when you see democracies happen. So we're going to be dealing with a lot of authoritarian governments that are struggling to manage their growing connectivity to the outside world. I think we should be involved in the process of helping them deal with their security issues. I think that's, by and large, a pretty light footprint. I think kind of withdrawing from the world on that basis and assuming it's going to fix itself, or the alternatives presented by the Chinese, for example, are going to be better, I think we're going to be pretty unhappy with those outcomes, and that these efforts that we make actually represent substantial investments on our part in a global world that's very much to our advantage.
What sort of changes do we need to expect in the world as we see the continued expansion of this global middle class?
Well, they're going to have resource requirements that are stunning. We got a taste of that last summer with the spiking of food prices, commodity prices, energy prices. Now, some of that was driven by speculation and the kind of furious pace that we had maintained at the end of this 27-year boom in the global economy. And since that boom has been pricked now, that bubble, and there's always a certain bubble element to it, we see a depression of that demand, but it's going to come back. And what that's going to demand from us is that we're going to have to shift off current patterns of energy use, current modes of energy use, and move to kind of cleaner, better, more efficient packages. A good example are cars in America. You know, we say to be mobile in America is to wrap yourself with 2.5 tons of steel and hurl yourself down the highway at 70, 80 miles an hour, you know, getting 15 miles per the gallon. Experts will look at that package and say only 1% of the energy we use in our cars actually makes us go forward. Can we reimagine that technology to make that middle class that's emerging around the world get mobile and be happy with those prospects? Enormous innovation challenge.
Thomas P.M. Barnett's new book is called Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.